Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 381.
I've been up a really long time, which is how I'm able to achieve maximum bassness in my voice. I was up in Northern California for Course of the Force. We ran a lightsaber across the Golden Gate Bridge and had the Jabba the Hutt pleasure barge, which created a little bit of traffic. Sorry, but it was worth it. It's for Make-A-Wish. You can see footage of this. The cosplay has been absolutely incredible. It's at youtube.com/nerdist. Click subscribe while you're there. Or you can also go to starwars.com/Course of the Force and see all the pics that we've been taking. We're almost to San Diego for Comic-Con International, so just a handful more days. If you go and you see on the map that we're going to be in a town that you live in, come by, say hi, come to one of the carnivals afterwards, and high-five us all and hug some people for running a lightsaber for charity. Thanks to everyone who's been involved so far. I would also like to point out that I will be performing at Just for Laughs in Montreal. I'm doing a show, a Talk of the Fest show. We're taping for Canadian television on July 23rd at Club Soda. There's two shows, so come to one of them. Montreal Just for Laughs Festival is, the website's hahaha.com. That's it, just hahaha.com. And then you can search for the show. I don't know if we're allowed to announce everything that we're doing there, but let's just say that I'll be there, and Jonah will be there, and Matt will probably be there, if that tells you anything. So, hahaha.com and search for the shows. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, audible.com. Go to audible.com/nerdist, get your free audiobook download. They have over 100,000 titles to choose from. You're going to find something. You've probably already listened to an audible book and you even know it. So if you listen to, a book that someone is reading and you're listening to with your ears, it probably came from Audible. I would like to recommend Neil Gaiman's new book, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, a novel.
I'm so sorry. I tried to make sure it was off.
Well, you really made sure.
I'm so sorry.
Well, turn it off.
It won't hit mute.
So
I don't even know what's playing right now. There it is. Okay.
What was that?
I don't know. All the windows opened at once.
Did you get a window storm?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm sorry.
Skynart won't open tabs. She just opens individual windows for everything. There's like a million of them on her desktop. And so, like,
I've got tabs in all of those windows.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So the most irritating thing is that some ad will start playing, and then it's like a fucking Easter egg hunt trying to find which window it's in somewhere.
I'm a window hoarder. I'm sorry.
Stop window hoarding.
Sorry.
Stop window hoarding.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Skynart's put up a long time, too. Do you have bassy voice?
I have bassy voice.
That's pretty bassy.
I have Busey voice.
You have Busey voice.
No, I don't. I can't do a Busey impression. Can you?
How much coke do you have? The Ocean at the End of the Lane, a novel read by Neil Gaiman, which, by the way, you could listen to Neil Gaiman read the ingredients on a taco shell box, and you would be completely enamored. So that's at audible.com/nerdist. Sign up and get your free audiobook. Thanks to Audible for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. This episode, which is Tig Notaro. And so if you listen to this podcast, you probably are aware of certain comedy circles, and you probably know what Tig went through last year. But it was basically just a confluence of awfulness. And she managed to come out the other side of it and hadn't really had a chance to sit down and talk with her about it until this podcast. And it's, I would say, if this makes any sense, this podcast is heavier than normal, but also lighter in a weird way. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's just, she speaks with such a frankness and an openness, and it's comforting. And she's one of the bravest people I know, and inspiring and hilarious in spite of everything that happened. I can easily say that this is one of my favorite episodes out of the almost 400 episodes we've done. It felt really special. And so here it is. It's the Nerdist Podcast number 381 with Tig Notaro, who, by the way, has a couple comedy specials that you should get at tignation.com. One of them's called Good One, and the other one is called Tig Notaro Live. It looks like live, but it's actually live. And you'll hear the whole story if you haven't heard about the special. But essentially, she goes on stage right after she found out that she had cancer, and the show was recorded, and it was her doing this set about all these horrible things that happened to her last year, and it was captured one night at Largo. And, well, I'm telling the story that she's going to tell, so I'm going to shut up. So here it is. Enjoy.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Do you want to put headphones on?
Yes, I do. Isn't that... Did I seem like I didn't?
Yeah, it seemed like you were just anti-headphone for a second.
Is this the right, left, right, left?
Red is right.
Right is red?
Mm-hmm. Red is right.
That's, both are correct.
That's correct, comrades.
Red is right.
Do you want to put headphones on, Tig? Jesus.
How about put those fucking headphones
That's
on?
That's more like
no.
it.
No. I'm glad to finally have you on the podcast. We almost had you on our live show in September, October in New York. And then I just sort of felt with everything that had gone on that maybe the live show was not the best place to...
What went on?
No.
We lost that recording anyway.
It was raining.
We got it back.
Well.
It was windy.
It was windy. It just wasn't right.
It was a little bit windy that
yeah.
day.
The weather led us.
Kind of cloudy.
Yeah, Mother Earth led us.
We're a weather-based podcast. We'll look at the we'll look at weather.com and I'll be like, oh, it's not, yeah. it's going to be a little overcast.
Look at the barometer, Chris. We can't have Tig on.
I mean.
For Christ's sake.
The barometric pressure is way too much to sustain a podcast right now. There's just no room for it. We need chance of precipitation below 30%, and then we can actually have a podcast. But it's nice to finally have you on.
Are we on?
This is it.
We're always on.
We got
on.
Started.
Yeah. We're always on.
Yeah.
Oh, I was waiting for it to get started.
Oh, okay. That happens a lot.
When does the Nerdist song start?
Da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Hey.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Is that the sitcom version of it?
Yep. That's the Bobby McFerrin version of it.
How is Bobby?
I haven't talked to him in ever. So
oh, my God. It's been a while.
He's been hanging out with Michael Winslow. I know that much.
Oh, my God. That'd be a terrible situation.
That'd be the fucking best situation.
You know what? We could recreate the Don't Worry, Be Happy video. We could get Robin and Bill Irwin and just shoot it again.
Yeah. But won't Bobby McFerrin not perform that song ever again?
He probably won't perform it ever again.
I checked out his
new
album.
That's like his rule.
He's just singing.
Right.
There's no, like, you know, boops.
What would make somebody check out Bobby McFerrin's new album? I mean,
Don't worry, be happy.
I know, but it's like, just waiting for that follow-up and like,
no,
how many has
no,
he put out?
Well, no, it's because, you know, I have like a music subscription service where I can stream new releases mm-hmm. and some of that. So I was looking through the new releases and I was like, Bobby McFerrin, I'm in for some soothing music.
And what's a little taste of something you heard?
A lot of strings, a lot of just kind of crooning.
Uh-huh. Strings and crooning.
Crooning. Yeah.
Everyone was happy in the 80s, though. I feel now it would just be like, sort of worry.
Oh, that's because Coke was so
be
abundant.
Be content.
But he wasn't about Coke.
I think
man.
People are more than sort of worried. I think people are panicked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a real bad situation going on right now as we speak.
There's a lot of pants shitting.
In Egypt.
Going on. Yes.
Well,
yes,
there's sure. been a lot of horrible things going on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
We're just more aware of yeah. them now yeah. than we've ever been before.
Instantly That's, aware.
It yeah. was much easier to, you know, essentially, you know, imagine that you're on a farm in the middle of the United mm-hmm. States somewhere.
I like it.
Take it there.
Okay.
What would you put on your farm? Would it be some chickens or a cow or two? It doesn't matter. But the point is...
One chicken.
I
would
a
buy
massive
a huge farm,
Just put one
and
chicken.
And put one chicken.
Well, that's why it's called One Chicken Farm.
Yes.
Yeah.
At the entrance, at the gate there.
Yeah. It was Twin Chicken Farms until Marty
until
hit it
Marty
the
hit one
yeah,
with
yeah,
the glory.
Exactly.
One Chicken Ranch.
Uno Pollo
one
Farms.
One Chicken Ranch.
Uno Pollo Ranchero.
Dude, a lot of creepy guys are showing up for
to
some reason.
To my One Chicken
yeah,
Ranch.
Yeah, but it is just literally a One Chicken Ranch.
Yes, please. Yeah. Out of here, buddy.
No.
Is it located anywhere near a two-horse town?
I don't want to say on the podcast. I don't want people to
yeah,
show
you're right.
up.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah.
want to. So you live on this One Chicken Ranch,
sure.
And well, actually, that sounds like the most expensive whorehouse in the Beverly Hills of Las Vegas. Oh, we live at One Chicken Ranch.
Why does that sound expensive? You know, it's one chicken,
like one Rodeo Drive. You know, like
oh,
one
oh,
Rodeo
oh, okay,
Drive.
Sure.
We live at One Chicken Ranch. Yeah. But just having the ability to be isolated from the not kind of really not knowing what's going on in the world, and you know, occasionally you'll get a newspaper or the Sears catalog will show up, but in general you live a very isolated existence, and you know, blissfully unaware of how horrible things actually can be in the world.
Yeah.
I know you've talked a lot about it before, but did
the chicken?
The chicken, yeah. Did going through the chicken change any of your perspective on any of that stuff?
Is it for eggs or meat?
Did I have the chicken?
Yeah.
Just for company.
Oh, you can't really do anything nice. To that chicken. Really yeah. nice. You don't want to be a no chicken ranch. Then it's just a ranch.
Which came first, the chicken or the company?
Well, yeah. Wait a minute.
That's stupid.
If you had a house chicken,
sure.
Do you count the house chicken as the ranch chicken, or is there a separate ranch chicken, but then you have a companion house chicken?
No, it's Chris. It's one chicken ranch. You can search all you want. There's not a second chicken.
I'm gonna tear this place apart in delight. There is under a floorboard
Chris
somewhere.
Chris Hardwick is back.
What are all these chickens doing under the floorboards? I'm sorry. I to justify.
What's with all these feathers in your car, Chris?
For tax reasons, I can only have one chicken.
You just, you just walk in. You feel one floorboard creak. You like pull it up. And there's just, there's just little heads.
Oh, nothing.
Yeah.
Your floors beginning. Are very balky.
You're basically in the beginning of Inglourious Basterds.
Yes. Yes, I'm a German. I'm a strange German who's just
if not normal.
I'm just telling a story about a chicken that I oh, this is interesting. What's under the floor? And then
is that a German?
Yeah, I was gonna say
that's a Christoph Waltz German English mashup accent.
Okay. All right.
Mashup.
I'll accept that.
Yep. That's what that is.
Thanks for being on Tig.
Absolutely. I want some time alone right now.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, like the
Should
chicken.
We get the chicken? Or?
Yes. I'm so used to just being around one chicken. This is very uncomfortable.
Do you know who we've just described? Gonzo from The Muppets. Gonzo lives on one chicken ranch.
No.
Tig lives on one chicken ranch.
Yes. Chris, you will not accept what is happening. I live. You try and make it.
This looks familiar. Vaguely.
That's a better German accent, actually.
Oh.
You have your accents messed up.
So I guess it appears that you might have some Jews hiding under the floor.
Gonzo!
Out of here!
That's Gonzo trying to deny his SS past, which he's managed to keep secret all these years. That's why he just befriends chickens. He was so horribly scarred by his war crimes that he could only. It's kind of like how in MASH, in that episode of MASH.
A terrible name for a boat, so, the SS pass.
Where Hawkeye keeps thinking a woman killed a chicken, but it was actually a baby that she smothered, but in his brain broke, and then he thought
it was
a chicken.
Is that a real episode?
That was the last episode. Yeah, he's in a psych ward. Spoiler alert. He's in a psych ward. And
yeah, no, don't tell me. Don't tell me.
He keeps having this recurring memory of how a woman kills a chicken on a bus, but then when he starts digging deeper, this doctor gets him to remember that he screams at this woman to shut up her baby, and not knowing what to do, she smothers the child. And he
Was this a sitcom?
It was until the last episode, and then he relives the fact that this was a horrible thing that he witnessed.
And
what is this?
MASH. 105 million people.
This is a comedy sitcom.
Oh, yep. God. I needed a laugh track with that.
That was more of a. That was more of a.
Comedy.
It was just more of a sit. The last one was just more of a sit.
When I was little.
Well, you're not huge.
I know. When I say that around Sarah Silverman, she's always like, when I say when I was little, who cares? I guess I'm saying she's made that joke.
Too. Okay, good.
We're about the same size.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah. We have this roughly the same build. Yeah.
Is that offensive?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I feel like we constantly admire each other's clothing.
We do.
I'm
yeah.
like, that's a fucking cool shirt you're wearing. I would love to
yeah,
wear
it.
Yeah,
I always
shirt.
Like your outfits and your build. What am I saying?
When you were little.
When I was little.
Sitcoms.
Oh, I thought the word sitcom meant sit calmly and watch this.
That's British sitcoms.
But I think it was because I was so... just full of energy, believe it or not, as a child, and I couldn't sit still. And so when I had to sit down and watch something, it felt like, you know.
It was a sitcom.
Yeah, just sit calmly, Tig, please.
For 1.5 hour.
Yes, for 20.
There are, I feel like a lot of comedies on television now are sitcoms. Just sit calmly.
Yeah, get through this.
Just let it distract you for 22 minutes.
See, I loved like Good Times and...
We all love Good Times.
Yeah, we all do love Good Times.
mean Dynamite Good Times, Jimmy Walker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why did you just make a mustache?
That's what he did. He'd go...
Because he had just a hint of a mustache.
What can I say?
Yep.
I don't need to go into all the sitcoms that I enjoyed, but I did enjoy a few in the 70s, and then I never sat calm again.
Is that, it's like after a show's already canceled, it was a sitcom?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sat calmly.
Sat calmed. You were sat calmed.
Yeah.
We can explore tenses on both of the words.
Would love to.
In this fun grammar play that we're all having. But I thought you had stopped. Did you take a break from stand-up for a while?
Well, I had cancer.
Well, I understand that. Yeah, but that doesn't mean...
I just pushed through.
You know, like, Louis was working on Conan. That was hard. He still got up and did sets. You just got to want it.
Let's see. Yeah, I took a break.
Well, I had cancer.
Well, yeah, I had a few things go terribly amiss.
I know you had cancer. I was really sad and worried about you, and I remember texting you when I found out that you were going to be okay and just being like, and I was genuinely, you know, even though we never hang out that much.
Ever,
we don't.
Yeah.
We see each other at shows, but you're still one of those people that I always feel like, I don't know. I feel like I have a fun connection to you, and I genuinely care about what happens to you. And I was really upset and worried for you. So I'm glad that you're okay, and I'm sorry that it happened. And how do you feel now coming out? You know, it's been about a year now.
It will be a year on July 25th that I was diagnosed. But like March. Is when I've already hit some 1 year marks of like, because it started with I had gotten pneumonia and then I took antibiotics, and I don't know if you know all this, but I had contracted this deadly thing called C. diff, and I was hospitalized for that and had lost 20 pounds. And then when I got out of the hospital, my mother tripped and hit her head and died.
Oh, Jesus
and
Christ.
Then my girlfriend and I broke up a few weeks after that. And then I was diagnosed with cancer. And so that was in a 4-month period of time. And so...
And at that point, you had to laugh, right?
Honestly, that's when I did. Nothing was funny.
Was it right when the car drove by and splashed you when you're on the sidewalk?
You're right. There are days.
And I shook my fist. But yeah, it was those year anniversaries have happened. You know, losing my mother and being hospitalized for the other illnesses and stuff. But now my year anniversary is coming up for cancer, and.
What are you guys going to do to celebrate?
I'm not sure.
Take the chicken out?
Yeah, by you guys, I'm assuming you mean me and the old chicken.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Just
run around the ranch, probably. That's all I really ever likes to do.
It's adorable. It was so there for me, though, through the cancer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But well, I'm going to head out. Huh?
Well, I've always said...
And I just want to go back to things that we like. You know that I was crazy about Hard and Firm.
Really?
Have I not told you that enough in your existence?
I don't know.
You don't remember me ever saying this?
I do remember you saying that.
It was just like the greatest thing.
It was fun.
I had ever scene. I enjoyed it so much.
It was fun. We still try to squeak stuff out every once in a while, mm-hmm. but we just don't. Our schedules are kind of crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, I just had to go back to that.
Well, it's sort of, you know, you work with people, like you'll make stuff with people, and then at a certain point you might have to sort of go separate ways, not for any bad reason, and then all of a sudden you look back and you go, that was a long time ago. Like, you must have had that with as long as you've been in comedy and just different people that you've worked with and different people that pop up in your life, and then you sort of you sort of move on without even realizing, like, oh, that phase is now over because it's just not happening anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, as far as Hard and Firm, I would always see y'all at festivals and shows and whatever, and for me that was always a highlight.
Well, I appreciate that. So you kind of. It was basically just a nesting doll of tragedy.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
For 4 straight months.
Yes.
And then, and you said, I mean, you have this legendary set from Largo where you just sort of showed up and was like, "Hey, this happened today.
Everything's horrible."
And someone happened to be recording it, and then.
Well, I knew they were recording it because I had done. An episode of This American Life, mm-hmm. and it was this story I've told many times about running into Taylor Dane, and it did well on the show, and Ira Glass called me a few days later going, your story has done really well, we want you back on immediately. And I was like, Ira, I was like, I don't feel like telling a funny story. My life is falling apart, and I feel like talking about that. And so he was like, okay, great, let's talk about that. And so I wrote up about 10 pages, and then I sent it to him, and we met in person, and I walked in, and he's looking at all these pages, and he was like, this is so depressing. And I was like, yeah, that's
my life. Remember before I was telling you.
But he was saying, I don't want you just to come in to the studio and tell me this story. He said, I feel like your strength is your performance. And so if any of this ever becomes funny to you, I think you should try and do it on stage. And I left his office just like giving him the bird.
Yeah.
I was like, find this funny. My mother just died. I'm going through a breakup. I'm 20 pounds less than I normally am. Like there was nothing funny to me. And then I was diagnosed with cancer, and everything became hilarious to me. And and so I went on stage, and I asked Largo to record it because I was going to see if I could get a rough cut of something.
Mm-hmm.
And it went better than I thought it was going to go. And so I emailed Ira and said, hey, I think I might have something that you could air.
Had you tried any of this stuff? So that was the one
and
that's probably why it felt so extra special too, is that it really was like, this is a one-time thing that just got captured and that's
it. I had been diagnosed on a Wednesday, and my show at Largo was supposed to be that weekend, and I called Flanagan, the owner, and I said, look, I just found out I have cancer, I'm just not in the mood to perform. And he said,
so Sunday then.
We'll get you up Monday then, all right?
Yeah. What's he called?
That I was gonna call back to the German accent, but so he said, why don't I move the show to the following week, just in some crazy, you know, some chance that you want to perform.
So he really did say then Sunday then.
Well he said the following week, and he said, but if up to the last minute you say no, we'll just take it off the books. Okay. He said, no problem, but maybe you'll want to perform. And I was like, there is no way. I was so upset. And and then the next week comes, and the day before my performance, I had put off going to find out the stage of cancer, prognosis, all that kind of stuff, because I was a little emotionally backed up.
Sure.
My friends were like, go to the, you know, because all I got was a phone call that I had cancer, essentially, and then I had to make an appointment to get the details. And so,
terrible week of waiting, like, to find the details.
Well, it was, but I was, again, so this was 4 months of like nonstop hell. And I was so dreading hearing there is no hope and you are dying. Like, I couldn't bring myself to find out what was going on, because they had found cancer in both breasts, and so it didn't sound great.
Never does.
Yeah, but I thought it was just one side, and then they're like, "Oh, there's tumors here," and so I was just, I was like, I can't process this, and so I went in the day before the show that I did at Largo, and the doctor was like, well, it's stage two. The tumor on the left is invasive, which means the cancer is not contained, and we will not know until surgery if this has spread or not. And I was just like, no, I just, this can't be my life. Like, I was devastated, and I was crying. Like, I'm not a crybaby, guys.
I don't think anyone would
consideration.
Tick.
Walk it off. Yeah. Like, no one's going to be.
No, I know, but I'm just saying in my regular life, I'm just not hyper.
Only two people have ever seen her cry, the doctor and the chicken.
Chicken's not a person,
it
buddy.
Counts. It counts.
But I was openly weeping on the sidewalk in my friend's arms, you know, like I was devastated. And so the next day I was on stage at Largo because I didn't know if my cancer had spread. I didn't know if I was living or dying. And I love doing stand-up. And I did feel like I had witnessed my life falling apart so quickly that I was in such shock that everything was going away. And so quickly that I had no reason to think that things were going to be okay. And so I was scared that was going to be my last time to perform, you know?
Oh, shit.
And I loved stand-up so much. So I was just like, I have to perform one more time, you know? And I was like, what if it is a good enough set that it could be on This American Life again? You know, I was like, I don't want to miss that opportunity either.
The
I was
performer just like, side, like...
Yeah, I was like...
Oh, there's going to be a lot of agents in the audience.
Right, I was trying to make it. I was hoping to get discovered.
Was part of you like... What if it doesn't go well? And then you're like...
Oh, I didn't think it was going to go well. There was no part of me that thought it was going to go well. I thought this was going to be the single most uncomfortably horrible show in the world. And so when I was getting laughs, and I didn't know how to go into the set to get into that material because it was so dark and weird. And about an hour and a half before the show, I was taking a shower, and I was just like, "How am I going to get into all this?" Like, and then I thought chronologically, I would keep it very linear. And then I was like, "No!" And it was that moment of true editing. You have to get to the point. What is the point? Well, the most pressing point is I have cancer. And so in the shower, I just pictured myself walking out on stage and being like, "Hi, I have cancer." And it was making me laugh so hard in the shower. And then I was like, I can't open a show waving at the audience saying, "Hi, I have cancer. How's everyone doing tonight?" And then I just kept, like, as I was driving to the show, I just kept replaying that and laughing so hard. And then and I was so nervous backstage because nobody, Bill Burr, Louis, Mary Lynn, and Ed Helms were all on the show, and nobody knew I was about to go out and do that. And I was just like, I didn't want to hear any advice or don't do that or, you know. And so I was like, ah! And when I hear that recording, I can hear my voice is shaking, you know. I was so scared to do that, but I mean, there were certainly awkward, uncomfortable moments, but it went so beyond what I could have ever imagined.
I remember seeing Louis tweet about it. She basically just said, like, "I just saw the most amazing set I've ever seen in my life."
Yeah, and Bill too.
And is it did it sort of change how you view comedy in the sense of, you know, you're yourself, you're a version of yourself on stage. You're talking about things that obviously you think are silly or funny, and so they are related to you. But just the idea of being in a situation where you had to go on stage as essentially vulnerable and open and honest as possible and sort of realizing, like, oh, maybe this is actually where comedy comes from.
Well, it's certainly comedy comes from that, but not only.
Sure.
And obviously, like, you guys are like, really? but in that moment, that was what was the funniest, silliest thing to me, was that I had cancer, you know? And it was the most pressing for me to talk about. I couldn't go on stage and do and talk about a run-in with Taylor Dane or anything like that. And so that's not my typical style. I like silliness. I love silliness, actually. And it was just that moment. And people kept asking me. I didn't do stand-up after I did that show for, I don't know, until a few months ago. I didn't do stand-up for, I don't know, 6 to 9 months. I really don't know. I haven't done the math. But everyone kept saying, has it changed you as a comedian? And I kept saying, I don't even know who I am anymore. I haven't performed since then. I don't know. And then when I started performing again, it was just silliness. You know, I'm not some hard-hitting comedian that's telling anything like it is, you know? And, but I realized that is who I am as a stand-up, is who I always was, you know?
Yeah.
It was just that moment in time. And I also think about just evolving as a comedian. One of the things that has been helpful for me has been to take my own advice, which has been, if I think something is funny, I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a one-line joke, a 20-minute story about Taylor Dane, a physical bit, crowd work, or telling the audience that I have cancer. You know, whenever I picture a comedian saying, this isn't my normal style, should I do it? There, no part of me would be like, if it's not your normal style, I would stick to, you know, that's not your thing, you know?
Right.
And so I feel like ultimately allowing myself to do those other type of things has made me grow as a comedian, but it's not the one thing I always return to.
Were you worried when you went back on stage that people were going to be like, oh, that's the woman who had cancer? Or like, were you worried that they were going to be really ginger around you, like gingerly around you and gentle because they, you know, like when people get very like, oh, is it okay? Is it all right to lie? Is it
yeah,
all right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, even when people would come over when I had when I had cancer before my surgery, and they just come over to, you know, visit with me. If I was, hey, can I get you some water? They'd be like, I'll get it. And guys, I can still walk, you know. But, you know, I've only done 3 real gigs since I've had cancer, meaning like road gigs. I did Bloomington, Durham, and Iowa City.
Mm-hmm.
And the major hot spots.
Actually, Bloomington, the Comedy Attic, is fucking great.
Yeah, I did. There's a theater there.
Oh, did you do the theater?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And but my label is there. I'm with Secretly Canadian. That's mm-hmm. an indie rock label, and they're out of Bloomington. And so I do Bloomington a lot. And Bloomington's... Actually, all those cities are amazing.
Yeah.
And when I went on stage, I was thinking, my fan base has grown and changed, and I wonder when I walk out on stage if people are going to feel like, you know, we better hear some heavy or cancer type stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
some confessional like biography.
Yeah, jokes. And if something comes up authentically, then I'll do it. But if I thought, well, I hope that my show is good enough that even if it's a housewife from middle America that is here, I hope she enjoys the silliness.
I think that's where, you know, having done comedy for over a decade, I would imagine that's where that kicks in, you know, where it's like maybe you might doubt yourself and go, I don't know if I can, you know, but then there's just something about that machine that you've tightened up all those years where it just kicks in and mm-hmm. you're a comic.
Like, yeah.
That's, you're just a comic.
Yeah. I mean, and it's actually been so fun because I feel, and I don't know if it's in my mind or if it's really there, but the feeling of winning over people that maybe only know me from my CD about cancer.
Right.
You know, where I'm like, oh, that was just a really fun show. And even if they came for one thing, I feel like they left thinking I'm amazing.
You don't want that to define you.
The cancer thing?
Yeah.
Right. And
I thought you meant being amazing. That would be a great thing to be defined by.
Oh, I knew he didn't mean amazing. I'm well aware that it's very much tied to me, but I don't care at all that it has been tied to me, because I feel like I have opportunities and I think I can move beyond. And even if I'm still always tied to it, I'm totally fine with, I'm not going to do my big cancer tour or, you know what I mean? But, I don't mind. It's been such a positive thing in my life that I feel lucky that I'm tied to that positive aspect of it.
Yeah. How important do you think comedy is for something like this? Like you said, when people are like, I'll get the water, that, you know, that we treat things.
And I'm like, thank you.
God bless you. Hey.
What happened to your voice all of a sudden?
Cancer.
Cancer. I don't know how it works, though. I guess it checks out.
This heavy remote. Could you?
Watching my sitcoms.
Now, when I got here, you were doing a bunch of yoga. So that's weird that now you're asking me to do all your errands.
Oh, you're going to tell me how cancer works.
Come on.
You're going to tell, all right.
Because when I have cancer, I know how cancer works. Yeah.
But when you did the show, did you feel during the set, did you feel relief afterwards? Did you feel hope? Did it give you anything? Or was it the second you were off stage, like, okay, now I got to go deal with all this shitty stuff again?
No, I felt elated. Because when I was on stage, I thought, I feel like this might be a really special moment in time. I didn't think, because Louis had called me the day after and said, hey, I think that show should be released for people to hear. And I was like, there's no way I'm releasing that show. It felt like I had been doing an open mic, you know? And so he was like insisting and saying, let me put it on my website, we'll release it. And I said, there's no way I'm releasing that. And he said, well, the opportunity will always be here if you change your mind. And so after like a month and a half, after talking to a bunch of friends, everybody was like, why would you not release that? And the thought of, well, this could help people. So I released it, and I'm so glad I did. But the show, I was so relieved it went well. And again, there are certainly awkward, uncomfortable moments in the CD. But in general, it went a million times better than I ever imagined.
I'm actually sort of impressed from the standpoint that, you know, when you think of, I think most people go, well, that's probably the worst thing that can happen to you. And then you pile on the other things that happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you were able to somehow stay inside your body and not
barely.
Just drift away, or not walk out on stage and go, I have cancer, and then pile of tears. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. the fact that somehow...
pile of tears.
Yeah, yeah. Basically that you would just collapse into a heap on, you know, like where you think, like, oh, I can do this. And then when you're talking about it out loud, the emotion of it just like, oh, no, this is actually way harder.
Well, there were a couple of times where I thought I was going to start crying during the show. And I remember thinking, do not start crying during this moment that you're talking about your mother dying or cancer. I just didn't want to feel pathetic, you know, and I wanted to appear strong. You know, it was kind of a, you know, fake it till you make it kind of feeling of I don't know how I'm going to get through all of this, but I cannot cry right now. I didn't want people to be like, oh, you know, I mean, they did feel that way at moments, and I saw people crying in the audience and shaking their head and in shock, and other people were laughing hysterically. It was such a crazy mix of what I was seeing in the audience, you know? And so a lot of times I'm performing, but I'm also trying to console people because I see people crying. And it was a very surreal experience. And I was thinking, whether I live or die, I will never have a show like this again.
Well, you're basically, you're laying out a smorgasbord of tragedy.
Yeah.
That that so many different people have so many different connection points to,
uh-huh.
Oh, I just lost someone to cancer, or I lost a parent, or I just went through a breakup, or I just, like, there's so many points at which someone can be like, oh, gosh, you know, like, it really is, that is, it could have just been about one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but I had to bring it all in there. My follow-up CD, my mother tripped and died. I felt so compelled to talk about it all, and I am glad that there was such a sense of relief when I got off stage, and all the other comedians were. Everybody was stunned.
Yeah.
It was the funniest thing to see. Like, Louis, Mary Lynn, Ed, Bill Burr followed me. And he said...
There's one guy that
anyone
can do
could
it.
Do it. Yeah. One guy could
he
it.
Annihilated. And he keeps telling me he's going to send me the audio of... from his
phone.
What do
I gotta do? Come out here and follow the chick that got cancer?
Like, yeah.
What am I supposed to do with that?
He had his phone recording when he was walking out, and I had gotten a standing ovation and that whole thing, of course.
Sure. Well,
they're not going to sit down and just like, yeah, good job.
Yeah.
Like, I guess
went
we have to
long.
Stand
she
up.
Went a bit long.
But I guess on his phone, there's him saying, yeah, what I'm supposed to follow this, and so there's our exchange while we're shaking hands, and I introduced him, and so he was on stage, and then I walked backstage to Ed and Mary Lynn and Louis, literally just jaws agape, just stunned because they found out a lot of information about me, I think as comedians they were just. Putting themselves in that position.
Well, not only that, but also I think, you know, just having, like I said, you know, when I said earlier, like, we don't really know each other as well, other than like, oh, you're someone that I would hang out with more, you know, but I think I always felt like you're guarded in a way. And so I don't really know that much about you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if maybe that might be a similar situation for a lot of comedians who have that relationship with you.
Guard went down.
And then the guard is just like, not only is the guard down, it just got blown off, you know, and it's really like, so not only are they empathizing, and then not only is there that selfish thing you do where you're like, I can't even imagine if I had to go through that, but then also, oh, this is Tig, we're seeing... Like, this is as, you know, emotionally naked as this person can be. Like, I went from not knowing to, like, I know every inch of you.
Right.
And so that they must have, you know.
No, that's a good point. I hadn't really thought about. I mean, I have thought about that in certain ways because with the press asking questions, they feel like I've been private, hard to get to know. But friends of mine or peers... I hadn't thought about that level that, I see these people all the time, but I don't really know. I know certain things. I know, you know, Jonah got married. You know?
I was even surprised you knew that.
but yeah, I just, and it has changed me to a certain degree with that, for sure.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, to be a comic backstage or to be anyone in the audience, you know, oh, I can't get a signal on my phone. Oh, you know, I can't. Mm-hmm. I got this dumb thing I got to turn in tomorrow. I got a dumb audition. Oh, that's right. There's an end point to everything, and it could come at any moment. Like that.
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, just the proximity to mortality and, you know, playing upon all those things that we bury most of the time.
Yeah.
Is but you know. But being able to wrap that in comedy is fucking, it's not easy to do. Like some people talk about tragic things and it's just like, this is just therapy for you. And this is kind of a bummer. And that's why it's been hard for me to really, really talk about super personal things on stage, is because when I start to, and I'm doing it a little more now, but when I start to, it just kind of bums people out. Like, I haven't honed the ability to spin it into comedy the way you or Mark or, you know, or Bill or Louie has.
Well, I mean, I don't, there's bits and pieces of it in the comedy that I'm writing right now, but it's hard to get in there. It's hard to, how do I approach this? And again, the idea of the shock value of just get to the point. I have cancer. How's everybody doing tonight? Everyone having a good time? Oh, because I was just diagnosed with cancer. I mean, I just was like, I have to go into it like that. I was maniacally laughing on the way to Largo, thinking about how insane that is going to be. And it was going to go either way. And it cracked it open like crazy.
Are you less... have you been able to go back and, you know, I always use The Onion as the perfect example of, you know, after 9/11, their first thing was, you know, America, what, something like America
their
yearns
movie?
To worry
oh.
about dumb stuff again.
Oh.
Like, people just want to worry. They uh-huh. want to go back to worrying about dumb stuff.
Yeah.
Did it sort of change that at all? Or do you still, or do you, are you sort of comfortably like, oh yeah, I can't, oh, my fucking phone didn't get, like, do you still worry about dumb stuff?
I mean, I don't feel like I was ever fully like that. And I always tell people that know me well wouldn't say, Tig needed this wake up call, you know? obviously, everyone can be more enlightened and more in touch with things than they are. Everybody. But I was talking to Louis actually a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking about September 11th and how when the planes were going into the buildings, the terrorists told the people on the flights to call their loved ones to say goodbye, and just that extra level of horror and terror to, you know, you're going to die, so say goodbye. And just as the plane gets closer to the building and you're making those calls, you're not thinking, I'm not going to call my sister. She stained that shirt of mine.
Right.
And, you know, my neighbor always, not that you're going to call your neighbor, bye. But those moments right before, it's just kind of a place where it's a visual where I try to imagine myself suspended in my life of the plane. And Louis was laughing at me going, I can't believe you're using September 11th when you have your own tragedy to pull from, mm-hmm. you know, but it's the visual of the plane almost hitting the building, and what phone call are you going to make, and what are you going to say? And it's only going to be, I love you. You know, that's all it's
going to
be.
Or are you going to make the call because you know, your last memory is going to be, I'm personally telling someone the worst thing that they could possibly
hear.
Like, do you just sort of freeze with, like, I think I just, you know, I don't think in that situation, I don't think I could call my mom and be like, hey, goodbye. Like, I think I would just have to be like, I can't be the one, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. But the visual itself is what I think about when I think about importance and do things now and do things mindfully and all that kind of hogwash.
Well, if you were that way before, I mean, if you were, you know, mostly that way before, then it might have been the thing that got you through it.
Quite possibly. I mean, I mean,
without going fucking completely crazy.
Yeah, I certainly had moments like that. I had such crazy breakdowns during this time where it was, I was unrecognizable to myself. And I always talk about with this the idea of surrendering, and it's such a forced in those situations. You know, I get the phone call, Tig, your mother slipped and she hit her head and she's not going to make it. Can I talk to her? No, she's never again. And You have to surrender. What is your other choice? You know, it's so tremendously painful, and it's hard to process. And you have cancer. It brought such crazy breakdowns for me. And even going down to, I had a double mastectomy, and even though I was relatively flat chested before, it's still, my body is different, you know? And I have scars now, and I thought that it was gonna, I did not want that. But now it's, you surrender, and living in reality is, I think, what brings happiness so much, is not listening to false stories in your head or putting yourself any place that's not real. When you're like, this is reality, it is so much more helpful. But getting through those times, it's so hard to get to reality immediately.
Well, especially because most of the time, I feel like we live these existences where we are terrified of pain. Mm-hmm. We're terrified of dread. You know, like I actually have the same thought about the last second before mm-hmm. the plane goes into the building, and what is, you know, is do you surrender, or do you just, are you freaking out? You know, can you not control? And it's, I think most of the people, it's like how most people are afraid of dying in a plane crash rather than dropping dead of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. When heart attacks kill more people, there's nothing dreadful about, like, oh, lights off. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, it's the process of knowing and dealing with it and having to relay it to other people or figure out how to, it's the fear of dread. It's the fear of experiencing pain. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you, I mean, not like you had a choice, but it sounds like you actually kind of willingly just let it happen, which is a pretty radical but logical tactic.
Well, yeah, it's a combination of both things. Of, I had to let it happen, but there's also a mindset of this is happening. It when you push it away and deny it. Which again, I went through a lot of that. There were 3 weeks I was inconsolable after my mother died, and I could not talk without hyperventilating. I was a wreck, and I honestly got to a point where I was like, "Am I ever going to be able to talk without crying?" Like I couldn't picture it. I just thought, well, I guess this is new
how
me.
It's be.
Is like when somebody says, "How's it going?" I'm like, okay, you know, it was just a lot of that, and I was like, "This is the new me." What do you think? And I don't even know I have cancer right now. But
Christ! Oh my God!
But that is the that's that point you have to get through of just that. You can't, you'd be this crazy robot if you didn't have that hyperventilating 3 weeks that, and then you go, okay, my mother is gone, you know?
And obviously I would imagine still very important, but sort of when you sort of parse it all out, like probably the bottom of the priority list is like, and you went through a breakup, but still fairly substantial thing to go through. And is it that kind of thing where you're like, really now is this really the
I mean, it was something where it was so ultimately good and okay. It was certainly stressful, but I'd only been with her 9 months. And so it wasn't like this, you know, the person right before her I had been with for 5 years.
Okay.
And so that would have been like, if that happened in the middle of it, I just would have been like, just lie to me right now.
Right.
Like, just, I'm going to lie to you and you lie to me. Let's do that. How about let's do that and we'll get through it. But I had only been with this person 6 months. When I got pneumonia, and everything went downhill from there. And it's one of those things where you go, we are not in this for the long haul, you know, like things start really creeping up and rearing its head, and you're getting through it, and we had reached this point. I had pushed her away so much, and when I had C. diff, which was actually even harder to go through than cancer because nobody knows what it is, and so I couldn't call people and be like, oh my God, I have C. diff. You know, because people are like, oh, well, so are you doing the show?
No, you don't understand.
No, no, no. I'm losing half a pound a day. I'm dying. You know, people die of kidney failure. Like, I'm dying. And so when that was happening, I was pushing her away because we hadn't been together very long. And I felt so vulnerable and so unattractive. I was just like, I was so disgusting, and I was just becoming this skeleton, and I was just like, just leave, please, please leave, just please get away from
me. You don't want to bear the responsibility of bumming someone else out.
I did not want to.
Isn't it crazy that we do that, that we just, you get to those moments where you're like, yeah, I probably do need someone right now, but I don't want to be responsible for making your life as shitty as I feel
mine
is now.
I needed somebody so desperately, but I was, and I'm not somebody that yells very easily, but I was like, get out of, like, please leave my life. You know, she's like, you want me to leave. And I was like, yes, please leave. Please, please leave. And so there was just this huge wedge that was between us, and it was a hard, hard, dark time. And she was very kind and generous and giving, but we were falling apart, and I had suggested time apart, and then she didn't want time apart, and then we saw each other and the distance was still there, and then it was just clear that I had reached the point where I said, you know, my life is so in purgatory right now, and this is an area where I can't be floating in a gray area. I can't be like, oh, so I wonder what's going to go on.
Yeah.
And she didn't text me back.
Yeah.
It's like the last thing you want to worry about.
I was like,
you're
essentially streamlining.
You're basically streamlining.
I have to be done with this. And so it ended, and it was, you know, it just, it's fine. I mean, we're not in contact. But I care about her, and I, you know, there's not really anybody where I'm like, well, I don't care about them.
Sure, sure, sure. But it is a weird thing about the emotional side of our brain, where you feel like no matter how much the other side of your brain wants to, like, I really should feel this way, or I really should do this, that sometimes you just can't reconcile the gap between your logical brain and your emotional brain, and your emotions, you cannot get them to go where you need them to go, or you can't get them to go where you want them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that effectively is heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
That you can be in a relationship, you know, like, you know, I've been in relationships in the past where I'm like, I really need to be more present, and I want to be more present in this relationship, mm-hmm. and I cannot make that happen for some reason. Mm-hmm. And what the fuck? Why mm-hmm. can't I control what I'm feeling?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, it's when I look back on that time, all I can think is thank you. You were amazing. And, I hope we talk again, you know. But it was such a weird ending.
Have you been able to date since, or were you? Did you mm-hmm. need to? Okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. You know, yeah. Sometimes you might need a little distance from everything.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you start feeling like everything's okay? Like, when did you? When were you able to wait? Because obviously, going into the surgery, you said they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't going to know till after the surgery. How long after going through all that, you know, did you wake up and, you know, you kind of wake up and you sort of do a quick survey of your emotions, and a lot of times you're like, nope, still shitty. Oh, still, there's a still thing there. And then how long was it before you were like, oh, you know, actually, not that bad today.
Yeah. Well, I had different levels of it because, you know, the odd thing when you ask, have I dated, was this is just crazy town, but I had run into somebody right after we split that I started seeing. And it was somebody that I always found attractive. And I was like, well, this is crazy that now we're involved, you know. And so it was such a – that made me feel good immediately. That happened actually before I was diagnosed. And then I was diagnosed, and then I went through surgery. So she went through that period of time with me. And it was – I couldn't believe – this person that I'd always found attractive, I was going through this with, because once I got the diagnosis, I thought, oh my God, awesome. I have to tell her I have cancer. This is going to be hot.
You'll never guess who it was. You'll never guess. Taylor Dane.
What? Bringing it all around.
It actually was. And no, but so it was a helpful time period. It wasn't a committed relationship. Sure. It was the perfect thing to happen during that time, the perfect person, time, and so that made me feel good and made me feel good about myself and my body, and now I feel almost cocky about myself and my body. Not really about myself, but I feel good about my body. I didn't get reconstructive surgery. I just have scars. I don't have nipples. I just have scars across my chest. And I was really uncomfortable at first. But now I'm like, yeah, that is what my body is. And so
you're like, I can run long distances. Nothing's chafing. What are these nipples all
my
about?
My dad doesn't have nipples anymore.
What?
Oh, yeah, he got a flesh-eating disease, and they had to like just scrape off.
Oh, now this comes out. Wow.
Yeah. It was like a weird, crazy form of strep that just was like eating away.
Did he get it from the water in Hawaii?
He got it from Taylor Dane.
So. Yes, you'll never guess.
Well, she was in the water. Yeah. And then he was near her.
She was just on Cupcake Wars last week.
Taylor I've heard.
Dane. Yeah.
Everybody saw me.
That's supposed to be like Gaffigan's Hot Pockets. Like, yeah. I know.
You love my voice?
I know.
Or Taylor Dane was there?
Taylor Dane is your Hot Pockets.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, Tig, I always talk about Cupcake Wars here.
So. I understand. Who doesn't? But yeah, so there's been different levels of feeling good. Like, I didn't expect that to happen as far as dating, for that to be immediate.
Yeah.
And because I felt like such damaged goods. And then my physical health, I started feeling good, you know, two or three months after my surgery, because I felt really vulnerable for a long time. Being in a car or out in public, I knew it wasn't going to happen, but I thought people were going to punch my chest, you know, because I had these like incisions, and it was so scary to walk around and be in a car. I was like, oh my God, if we wreck, my chest is going to
blow.
Yeah. I was, and hugging people. So it took a few months to physically feel okay. And my situation with C. diff turned around, and I started being able to ingest food again. And
hey.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then, you know, like I had moved to New York. Amy Schumer had hired me to work on her show in New York before I was diagnosed. And she and the network were all so kind. And, you know, I was essentially being paid to have cancer because my trip out to New York got delayed.
Sure.
And I was trying to work and pitch ideas and jokes through Skype and whatever. But I was, you know, it was really a hard time.
Sure.
And then I got out there with stitches in my chest. I wanted to be back into my life immediately. And Sarah Silverman flew with me. We flew together to New York, and so she could carry my suitcases and whatever. I couldn't lift anything. I couldn't do anything.
Just any strain or
something. Yeah. And then I was in an office, and I was now I'm looking back and realizing I was just going through the motions of trying to be alive again. You know what I mean? I didn't feel right yet. I'm certain I appeared it to some degree to people, and because Amy would always say, she's like, I always forget that like you had cancer. And we would be, and I'd be like, oh, I'm aware. You know, I there was so much going on in my head that it was, and I'm just so thankful for that time, because I was really trying to acclimate. And, but once I got back to LA after I moved back from New York, I remember I woke up and I think it was January 1st and walked out of my apartment. I felt like Mary Tyler Moore, you know, like the opening sequence. Like I was like, oh my gosh, it felt so symbolic that it was January 1st, 2013. I just moved back the day before, woke up in my own place. My scars, you know, my incisions had healed, and I just was like, all right, I think I'm back, you know? And so that was like, there were so many different layers, I guess is my point, from reconciling with my body and my emotional state of mind. And there, it was a journey.
When you look at 2012, do you think of it as like a lost year?
No. It was not at all.
What do you think of it as, like, when you're categorizing it?
It was so, aside from losing my mother, you know, because that it you know, there were times where I've thought, I think I know what it would be like to lose my mother. I think I can get in touch with that. It was something I couldn't even imagine. It was a pain I'd never experienced that pain. And so aside from that, everything from, I mean, I really felt like I was facing death with C. diff, and my breakup and realizing what I want and what I'm looking for and what I can do, and to my stand-up set, to everything that opened, negative or positive, was so mind-blowing to me. I was pushed to such the edge of things so quickly that there's no way that year is wasted. Like the view that I got was so incredible, and I'm so thankful for, because everything birthed such grand amazingness.
Well, I'm glad that you're able to have that view that I think a lot of people may not necessarily have. But you also don't, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's like, but in the end, aren't you thankful? You know, because I imagine sometimes you could say that to someone and they'd be like, no, fuck you. Why would anyone ever want to go through any of this?
No, so. I'm beyond thankful. I feel lucky. I'm writing a book and exploring. It's about that 4-month period of time. And, you know, I spin off and explain my mother and explain our relationship, which was very complicated. And it's so different from writing stand-up, you know, writing a book, just really, really getting in touch with my surroundings and feelings. I kind of don't know what I was saying, but other than...
But to relive it by writing it is also a pretty... That seems pretty consistent with the sense of... I feel like, you know... I mean, it is really amazing that you've been or if you were afraid, you push through it anyway, but not afraid to face the pain head on. Like, you did it with the stand-up, you know, you went through it, you immediately dealt with it. You know, it has not quite been a year, but you're already writing the book, and still in the book, you're dredging up things forgot about or hadn't realized yet.
Yes, and I've been a crybaby doing that too. Like writing the book and I relive a moment of when my stepfather called me, you know, and really not just what I felt, but what he must have been feeling to make that phone call and calling my brother. Just there's so many things that it digs up, but I feel lucky. We're all lucky as entertainers, writers, performers that, because I'm constantly thinking, how do people get it out? How, we're so lucky that we can.
Someone doesn't, no, most people don't have a stand-up show that they can go.
Yeah, or a book. I mean, you could go write a book, sure. But people don't always do that. And so I feel, I'm so lucky. And I always say, I feel like I was the perfect person to go through this because I had money in the bank and work coming up and health insurance and friends and family. And I get so many emails from people that are dying, that are weeks away from their death, and people that have lost people or that are just having a rotten day. And they're just like, you have helped me so much. And I feel like I can do this. I feel like I can face this. I feel like I can die. I feel, not because of me, but just having strength. And I feel, that's why it goes back to, I feel so lucky. 2012 was not a waste. If I'm forever tied to this story, I feel lucky to be, because it's an experience. I couldn't have imagined this. And it's not just about, oh yeah, I'm busier with my career and I've had more success and that's great. But there's really something that it has done to me, and it's been such a gift. And it sounds cheesy and cliche, but it's so true. I don't know how people wouldn't experience that feeling, or, you know, especially being, and when I was saying I talked to Louis a couple of weeks ago, one of the things that I talked to him about was the word bravery. And I don't know, you were talking about how meeting it head on, and I said, it's uncomfortable to, when you're diagnosed with cancer, you're immediately called brave. And I was telling him, I kind of felt a little weird, you know, getting that word tied to me, and I didn't feel brave. You know, if somebody came over to my house, you would see somebody in fetal position on the couch or in bed crying for their mother. I didn't feel brave. And Louis was saying, but bravery is the capacity. It's not saying you don't feel scared.
No, it's pushing through it anyway.
Yeah. And because I was picturing, like, what if the military needed me, and they were just right. Like, we need some brave.
That's a good question. Right.
You know,
that's
like,
you think, you think of like Braveheart, yeah, where it's like, oh, I have to storm everyone with right. spears. Like,
Tig, we need you on the front lines.
Yes. Yeah. So I was like, what if they come to get me and they put like a rifle in my hands or something? And they're like, we're looking for a brave person. There she is. And I'm like,
I mean, I
have cancer. I need my mother.
But I think if someone doesn't feel fear, then they're a sociopath. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I absolutely agree with Louis. I think the bravery thing is like, this is terrifying. Somehow I'm going to find the strength to do it anyway. Doing that show was fucking insanely brave, because you don't know how you're going to, what it's going to, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to be able to handle it. You don't know if the audience is going to be able to handle it.
I don't know if I'm living.
You don't know if you're living or dying. And somehow you just did it. You just did it anyway. And you pushed through it. I think that's, you know, I don't think it's necessarily in the presentation of like, oh, I cried, or oh, I had a freak out or whatever. I think that's just human, like, you know, but to somehow find the wherewithal to focus and push through anyway, that's an insane amount of bravery.
It is nice to have that perspective on bravery, because I did feel embarrassed, and like I wanted to always speak up and be like, I have to tell you something, I'm actually not brave.
I think you're thinking of that idea that most people have of like cinematic bravery,
sure,
of like,
sure,
come on, just follow me, we'll get, you know, the guy who's been shot nine times and he's like, is that all you got, you know?
Which it kind of was, but no, I needed that shift in perspective, you know, because it was uncomfortable, the amount that people use the word bravery.
And so this, has any of this, just sort of shifting gears a little bit, has any of this followed into, because you're doing you want to do a tour.
I want to do a tour.
Didn't you, you're touring you want to like tour people's houses.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Showtime's filming me touring my fans' homes. I'm going to be doing shows in living rooms, rooftops, barns, basements. One chicken ranch, you know.
Your own place.
Yes.
They're going to let you shoot at your own home.
Advantage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to go work out some new material on the road. And then I'm probably going to eventually do a more proper tour. But right now I'm focusing on my book and then my CD that we've talked about, Live. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in hard copy, which I'm excited about, and a picture disc. They're making 500,
vinyl. Awesome.
I can't wait to get Tig Notaro live. No, it's Live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I named that.
Are you sure you want people to
well, I just
live and live.
Well, cause so many comedy and music albums are called Live, as you know. And, so I just thought it'd be funny if I called it Live and had to always correct people.
So Tig Notaro Live. No, Live.
No, it's actually Live.
Are you sure?
Because
it was a live show.
Yeah. I always thought it was a funny idea. And then when this happened, it was just perfect to call this album Live. Yeah. And so that's my album.
Did you immediately kind of start... You know, once you started feeling better, where you're like, here's 10 things I always wanted to do that now I'm going to go do quickly. Like,
did do you mean bucket list?
Yes. did you have a retroactive bucket list? Or at the time, did you sort of feel like, I guess I did everything. I don't know.
Well, you know, it's funny because it's not really funny, but it's funny. When I was home... When my mother died, I was in the middle of having C. diff and withering away, I was crying under my bed, and I was just thinking, how is it that I'm about to die right after my mother? And I was kind of replaying my life and thinking how I've had such a crazy, amazing life. And I wasn't thinking this like, I'm ready to die. But I thought, I'm about to die. So I was trying to come to grips with that. And I was thinking how I have traveled the world. I have my career. I mean, all I ever wanted to do was an open mic. I mean, I had no real... I didn't move to LA to do... I followed friends because they moved here and I had no real direction, you know? And I did an open mic. And so I just, it was so beyond, I've been in love. I have amazing friends. I was really going through that. And so I felt like if I do die, I'm not somebody that's in a third world country that my entire existence was hell. And then somebody murdered me. And you know what I mean? Like I've had an unbelievable life. And so I've always had this kind of joke real thing that I've done called How About Now, How About Right Now. And my friends Beth and Leslie that I moved to LA with, that Beth had direction and Leslie and I just got in the car and and then we went out here. But I always did this thing, How About Now, How About Right Now. And it's just like you're driving down the road, you pass a bowling alley at 10 in the morning. It's like, how about now? How about right now? You know, and like 5 minutes later, you have bowling shoes on and you're bowling at 10 in the morning and it just like jolts you alive. You know, you're like, oh my God, we're bowling. This is so stupid. Nobody's here, you know? And so how about now? How about right now has always been in my life, but more than ever, it's how about now? How about right now?
Is that the name of the book?
No. But it's going to be the name of something.
It's got to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a song that I've been working on with this slam poet that I know in Boulder. She's brilliant. Her name's Andrea Gibson. And I called her with this idea that I wanted to collaborate and had all these visuals and ideas of just really living your life and how about now, how about right now. And so the recording she sent to me last week, my head exploded. I'm so excited about it. I'm so excited about this.
When's the song going to be done?
I'm not quite sure. It's
how about now? How about right
now? How about now?
Now?
That's a good one, Chris. Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, hopefully soon. Hopefully real soon. That's the follow-up.
No, that's Matt's follow-up. Yeah. The Myra method.
Yeah, hopefully I'll get it right.
Hopefully soon, maybe soon.
Is your book going to be called Reed by Tig Notaro? But then everyone's going to say Red. You're going, it's Reed.
Good one.
Yeah. That's good. It's like the recurring. Yeah. The recurring. I think the trick is she doesn't want to stick to the same thing over and over again. It's just like that was the one.
I haven't even thought about anything, to be honest.
Except that chicken waiting for you in that house. Now I feel like I have to get you a chicken as a joke. I feel like I have to send you a chicken, but then that's going to...
Get me a chicken sincerely, Chris.
Ooh, a chicken sincerely sounds really good right now.
Yeah.
Nice sincere on
when
the skin.
Bark. Bark.
When I go out to eat and I have ordered chicken in the past, I like to order it as chickens. Because it sounds so personal, you know? I'll have chickens. Do you serve chickens?
Well, we serve chicken. Yeah, but if there's a few pieces, do I know that those are from the same one?
Yeah, chickens. Yeah. I would like to eat chickens tonight. Yeah,
we have chicken. Only one?
Yeah.
You're a restaurant. You should get more.
Hey, I've got the one chicken place. You're a restaurant. I expect more from you.
Yeah, one chicken
ranch.
But so, yeah, I don't have like an exact list, just to wrap
that
up.
Try that salad dressing on the Sincerely Chicken.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You wouldn't go into a place and go, do you have a hamburger? You go, do you have hamburgers? Do you guys serve hamburgers?
Yeah.
You got fries?
Yeah, chickens.
You have chickens?
Yeah, I'd like to eat some chickens tonight. It endlessly tickles me. Like years, decades into me at restaurants asking for chickens to eat chickens tonight.
That's going to be the moment when you're right at that building.
Yeah, the plane's going to the building.
You're going to look at the menu and it says chicken. You're gonna be like,
I'm chickens? Ordering a meal on the flight that's going into the building.
Why aren't they coming?
Yes, oh, the chickens?
Yeah. Why is no one paying attention to me?
Was when you were just sort of in wrapping up, I'm curious to know when you were traveling with Sarah and you were spending time with Sarah and you were going through this, was she... what I assume Sarah would be was like compassionate, but also cracking a lot of jokes to try to make you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a favorite cancer joke of Sarah's?
Well, the best one that she did, she in traveling, I showed up because for a while I had to just wear button downs because I couldn't pull t-shirts on or off. And so I was always wearing button downs. But when I met her, and this isn't a joke or anything, but she just, when I showed up at the airport and I just had on a white t-shirt, she's like, oh my God, you look so extra Fonzie cute, you know, just like, or tiny Fonzie cute, in your t-shirt. And then at the hospital, she met me there at 6 a.m. for my surgery, and she was there before I got there, and when I walked into the lobby, I was with my aunt too. My aunt had driven up from Oceanside, and so my aunt hadn't met Sarah yet, and we walked into the hospital, and Sarah was in the lobby, and she's like, "Oh my God, did you already have the surgery done?" It killed me. It was just she kills me.
Yeah. You are also like, beset with everything else that you said, you're also very fortunate that you have like the funniest friends that anyone could possibly have.
It's like the funniest people in the world
are your friends.
Happen to be my friends.
They're your support group.
Yeah. Yeah. And my hospital room was a suite, and I woke up just so drugged, and my room was just overflowing. I'm sure the people at the hospital were just like, who is this? You know, what is going on?
They actually started an open mic in your room.
They did. did they
really?
Yes. And they were doing, I was like, I was, I, comedians, yes, they were doing their sets in my room. Oh, I was lying in my hospital bed requesting bits and for the next person to go up. I was like out of my mind drugged.
Beep. All right, I'll just wrap it up with this one last.
No, I'm flatlining.
Yeah, you're flatlining. Yeah, that's right. You're flatlining. Okay, oh, I'll just wrap it up.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. My aunt was just sitting there going, you know, here I've been worried about you without your mother and all of this that you're going through. And she just loved my friends and how... Just she just felt so good and relieved and that she could leave town and not just leave me, but just, you know, that I was clearly in good hands. You know, my friends were fighting to spend the night with me and go home and take care of me. It was overload of care.
How come we didn't get any time? And that's a comic thing. How come I didn't get to perform?
Who booked that hospital room?
Who booked that? God, I don't know. Was it like a draw from a...
The chicken. The chicken.
Did they draw from
it.
A...
Fucking chicken.
Yeah, the chicken books the hospital suite. Yeah.
Well, thank you for... Thanks for coming on.
I'm not leaving. I have more to say.
You can talk more.
No, thanks for having me.
No. And you know, I'm sure you've talked about all of this
First time.
But I really... You know, I was always nervous because I didn't. When I texted you, I sort of felt like I wanted to, and I think I may have even said this in an email. I kind of wanted to be on top of you, to be like, "Okay, are you okay?"
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought everyone's probably doing that, mm-hmm. and I don't know you well enough, and I don't know if that's okay. And I didn't. I was worried that. I was going to be one more person. I'm like, please just fucking leave me alone.
Stop caring about me.
Just know that Chris is a really caring person. If you took anything from
that. No, but seriously.
Here's the thing is that was another amazing thing about what I went through. And that is that, first of all, I appreciate that. And I was not, as you can imagine, ever being like, where's Chris Hardwick?
No, I know that. I know that.
No, of course. Of course you know that. But... Even if there are people that I didn't hear from, which I pretty much heard from everybody, and people that I had like three people in my life that I was not on great terms with, and I heard from them. And I've been so lucky to have this crazy clean slate in life where, except my most recent ex, I know she doesn't hate me or anything,
right.
but the amazing thing that I learned is that you can't gauge, you know, people have their strengths and weaknesses. And this isn't directly talking to you, but it's kind of a spinoff of that is I had friends that could do things in certain ways, but they could not help me in other ways. And if you took it, If you wanted to really take it personally, you could be like, and this person didn't call to do this.
Right.
And
that's
their weakness. And it doesn't make them a bad person. And it doesn't wash away your entire friendship.
Right.
That's a weakness that they have. And I still love my friends that fell short or could have been seen as falling short in ways. Because they... really have not fallen short in our friendship in other ways at other times. And they're facing their own issues with what I'm going through.
Right.
And that's really what I learned. I knew that before all of this hell went on, but I really got it.
Yeah, some people are going to jump right in and other people are going to be too freaked out because it's just the proximity of it's horrifying to them.
For whatever reason in their life and for whatever reason in our friendship or their abilities, and you have to just go, I'm not going to write this person off.
Yeah.
You know?
I think for me it was sort of going like, well, we're pals, but we're not like really great friends. We don't know each other. And I don't know. I didn't want you to feel the responsibility of like, now you have to explain all this to me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really around much before, but here I am,
you know?
And so I just didn't really know what I could do I just didn't know what I was supposed to do. And yeah, so I wrote an email, which I actually kind of cried while I was writing it, because I don't know. It was a very weird, you know, it felt scary. And I was like, I don't know what I'm to do to help. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And I don't know this person very well, but I just want her to know that I care, and I don't want anything to happen to her.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I appreciate that. I do. I mean, even when I just ran into people and they're like, hey, how are you? How's your health? Or I see strangers on the street. I'm walking across the street and somebody's like, hey, I know you have weird food issues, but there's a really great restaurant over, you know, and it's just like, everything is so good.
Yeah.
And where I'm just like, you're awesome. Thank you. You know, or even if somebody, I can tell they're uncomfortable talking to me about it, I'm fine with whatever. If people are uncomfortable or they are just like, I'm fine. I feel so good. And I get it. And on a very close personal level, I like I said, friends could have seemed like they fell short, but they didn't. It's fine. You know, it's a huge, I feel so lucky.
Well, it's great to see you, and I'm glad to hear you're doing stand-up again. And, you know, let us know when you're doing when you start doing the tour, and, you know.
I start in a few weeks.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah. There's a video that Showtime put up that people, when does this go out?
We can put this up is whenever you want.
Oh, how about now? How about right now?
Oh, shit!
Ah!
Oh, live stream.
But, yeah, Showtime has a YouTube page, and also I have a Facebook fan page that it's on, the video that you can go to that sends you. Oh, well, it's tigroadtrip.com. And you fill out a form and send in pictures and videos, and then I decide if I'm coming over to your house. So, and I'm going to be with John Doerr.
Oh, fucking great.
Yeah. He's going to be my sidekick.
Oh, he's going to be so perfect in that situation.
Yeah, it's going to be so much fun. So.
All right. And also Tig Notaro on Twitter, at Tig Notaro on
not
Twitter.
On Twitter.
You're not on Twitter?
No, sir.
You have to be. You're not?
Not on Twitter, not on Instagram, not on the little video Vine thing.
Why did I think someone is post? There's not a Tig Notaro on Twitter?
There's like fan things.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's what
but
I saw.
But I'm not on there. I post on my fan page on Facebook here and there.
Okay.
Under but, MySpace page, she still keeps that up.
And Friendster.
Yeah.
And her live journal. Still.
Mm-hmm. Oh, live journal.
I guess, well...
Normally, so my Facebook fan page would be...
Would be the place.
Yeah.
Normally we'd say people enjoy their burrito at the end of the podcast, but I think we have to end it by saying, how about now? How about right now?
Great.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Oh, that was a disaster.
Sorry about that.
God damn it. I thought you were going to bring it.
Chris, we're still recording.
What?
That's okay. I've learned my lesson in life, and it's that everything's fine. Help.
It's too late.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.